Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This podcast contains explicit language.
So that happened. It was just over a year ago that a Texas woman named Sandra Bland died under mysterious circumstances while being held in jail after being arrested at a routine traffic stop. Among the many unanswered questions was this: how often does this sort of thing happen? Well, in one of the most exhaustive investigations the Huffington Post has ever undertaken, we scoured the public records to find out how many people have died in jail in the year since Sandra Bland's death. And what we discovered was staggering. Joining us to discuss it today are the two lead reporters on the story, Ryan Riley and Dana Liebelson. Meanwhile, this week, Vermont Independent Senator Bernie Sanders bestowed his endorsement upon Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton. But while there's now a larger unity among the broader Democratic base, it was a bitter moment for Sanders' diehard supporters. We're joined by one such diehard, Tim Black, the host of The Tim Black Show, who will give us an idea about the future of Sanders' movement and what, if anything, Clinton can do to win people like him over. Finally, we are taking our talents to Capitol Hill this week to visit Wisconsin representative and friend of the podcast, Reed Ribble, at his office. The retiring congressman talks about one last piece of bipartisan business he hopes to get done before he heads home, and we'll ask him if a little bit of legislator quid pro quo might actually help Congress function again. I'm Jason Linkins with Huffington Post reporters Zach Carter, Arthur Delaney, Dana Liebelson, Ryan Riley, and Lauren Weber. All of that, plus we'll preview the upcoming Republican and Democratic conventions. But here's what happened first. Hello, everybody. Welcome to another edition of So That Happened, your weekly digest on political goings-on. My name is Jason Linkins. I'm the editor of Eat the Press at the Huffington Post. This week, a peaceable kingdom was made, at least the appearance of one, in the Democratic Party when Bernie Sanders, senator from Vermont, came together with Hillary Clinton in New Hampshire to provide her with the endorsement she has sought since the AP gave her the clinching bid of the nomination. But it does raise a lot of questions about whether Sanders supporters feel like the Sanders campaign got everything out of this whole process that they deserved and wanted. And what will Bernie Sanders supporters do from here now that the primary is technically and officially over, and we're moving on to conventions and the general election? Joining me to talk about this is my colleague Arthur Delaney.
Hi.
And on the phone, we are happy to have Tim Black, host of The Tim Black Show, which you can find on YouTube and iTunes. Tim, how are you doing today?
Man, I'm over here licking my wounds, Jason. I'm over here just struggling after listening to what appeared to be, man, the end of Bernie Sanders' progressive movement for him as the leader of it, I should say.
So, Tim Black, on Tuesday, Sanders made a really rousing endorsement of his rival Hillary Clinton, but you're not feeling that? You're not persuaded by Bernie that's time to support Clinton?
It feels like politics, Jason. It feels like politics. It feels like Bernie said what he needed to say, and I just can't get behind that. I can't support it. I mean, I've told people all along that, yes, you know, Bernie is in this position with us in this movement, but at any point in time, other people will need to step up. He is not a one-man movement, and that's why we have other people. That's why I'm out there. That's why H.A. Goodman's out there, Debbie Lou Signet, Mike Figueredo. We're all out here, too, all of us pulling together. So, man, we got to do it now because Bernie has really, I'm not going to lie to you, Jason, this was a hard hit to the movement.
Well, don't you think the movement deserves a lot of credit? There was a lot of argument as to whether Bernie Sanders should hold out as long as he did. And I sort of never caught into that notion. I thought that he may as well stay in and keep working at the margins to get what he wants out of this process. by and large, I think the Democratic Party platform as a document, we know it's a non-binding document, but it does sort of set like party squad goals for the coming election. It's much improved over the last Democratic Party platform. And I think that Sanders and the people that he sent to the platform committee deserve a lot of credit for making some pretty big changes.
Yeah, you know, the thing is, man, you can't spend wet nickels. Like, you know, I don't know if this is a real – is this real currency that we have with the Democratic Party? Or did they just – the DNC just kind of say, well, you know what, hey, let's throw these guys a bone and at least shut them up for a while and maybe we can win this election and then we can go back to being what we were. We can do a little shape-shifting. And that's the problem, man. See, I don't know. And how will you ever know if they will stick to – these allowances that they made? And if you got to push me left or you got to push someone left, when the time comes, will they stay left?
Tim Black, are there a few specific things that Sanders campaigned on that you're concerned Hillary Clinton doesn't really agree with?
I think if you want to put a dent into the prison industrial complex, which is a very important issue for me and my constituents, man, you got to decriminalize marijuana. You just got to do it, brother. That's a concern. The college tuition, they kind of made some concessions there too. I mean, if you're making, I don't know about you, but you know, $85,000 is not a lot of money for a family to make. I mean, somebody could make that amount of money if they got four kids and not be able to qualify for the tuition idea that Hillary and DNC have signed off on. So that's still a concern. I mean, we could go on and on, but more so, I'm looking at also the war hawkishness of Hillary.
Yeah.
That's the real concern, man. Like, we are looking at this and we're going, guys, this no-fly zone over Syria, these thoughts that Hillary has had, these votes she's made. Folks, I do not want World War III. And I will not be afraid of Trump to the point where I would vote for that.
So there are a few things that Sanders himself mentioned in his endorsement speech. He said Hillary Clinton supports public health insurance, lowering the age for Medicare, allowing Medicare to negotiate prescription drug prices, and of course, the Democratic platform being more liberal. And those don't feel to you like such great...
Oh, they do. They do appeal to Jason. Yeah. See, that's the thing. They appeal to me, brother. It's just, I don't know if she will stay that way. Hillary has been for everything and against everything at some point in time. One thing about Bernie, he's pretty much been Bernie. Call him cantankerous, call him, you know, stubborn, but at least he sticks to his guns. And not Hillary kind of doing the move thing from time to time. We don't know what we're getting. That's the problem.
Just, I think that there's probably going to be another big sort of inter-party fight as the action moves from the platform committee to the rules committee now. But I wanted to sort of like... just sound you out on the future of Bernie Sanders' movement, which you seemed a little bit downcast on in terms of like Sanders' ability to now serve as the de facto leader of that movement. But throughout this entire process, I've kind of thought that one of the things that this process has demonstrated is that maybe it's a little bit overrated to be president. I know that sounds crazy. I think that Democrats tend to think of the presidency as like the big show. It's the big dance. That's the job you got to compete for. But I see the progressives are getting outworked at local and state levels and state legislatures and county boards across the country. And I don't see a lot of Democrats even competing to run for some of these offices. Is there a possibility that the Sanders movement could become a larger, wider electoral movement competing in these sort of seats out there? Because my thought on this is that for all the complaints about superdelegates, you get to be a superdelegate when you're literally just a member of the House of Representatives, a member of the Senate. You get to the Senate by starting small and working your way up, as Bernie did. He was the mayor of Burlington, Vermont. Isn't there a chance that maybe in a few election cycles we could see people from the Sanders movement becoming those superdelegates, if we don't get rid of them, that is?
Right. Man, now you're talking, and that's what I just put together a video on Facebook and on YouTube, man, where I say pretty much that. But now, I'm not saying Bernie's a sellout. Some people are really going to the extremes. They're very emotional right now. What I'm saying is Bernie has started something. It's our job to finish it. We need to focus on down-ticket ballots. We need to focus on Congress people and getting people in city councils and expanding our reach and reaching out to other politicians who hold progressive beliefs. We cannot tune out now. Because see, that's the fear I have, Jason, that people going to put their heads under a rock and say, I hate politics. I don't want to do this. No. This is where we have to double down. So I'm with you all the way, brother. We need to now refocus our energy and realign ourselves and realize that, hey, we can't just expect this to happen overnight. You don't just add water and win an election and win the presidency. We have to build from the ground up, and we need to do that through grassroots. We have it in place. Let's go do it. My thing is we got to get money out of politics. But until then, we have to fight to get to fund the candidates that we believe in, so they don't have to take that special interest money. They can take our money, and we will fund our people.
So, Tim Black, is that going to be Jill Stein for you in this election?
You know what? I just reached out to Jill Stein's people, Gloria Materis. I just texted her. I do want to get Jill on my show and talk to her about it. I'm not, you know, we got to vet Jill. We got to take a real good look. I know we talked about it, and I'm Bernie a bus, but I really need to have that conversation because I know that my viewers, they are going to be doubly suspicious now. And I want to make sure that if they do this, that we do it for the right reasons, not just because we're jumping and pivoting, but we actually have thought out what we're doing, because this is a big move for us to make this move, and I don't know if today is the day to make that decision.
How do you like Donald Trump?
Look, let's make something perfectly clear, man. I wish Donald Trump would shut his big mouth. I'm not interested in Donald Trump. These empty trumpets, these empty suit trumpets that are on the internet that are approaching me now. Listen, I have no interest in none of my followers, the people that listen to the Tim Black Show are interested in Trump. Let's not go that far. That's crazy talk.
I'm gonna ask you to use your imagination. Is there anything that Hillary Clinton can do in the months ahead that would win you over? Yeah, that's what I'm looking for.
Deal the deal. Yeah. Well, you know, man, see, that's the thing, brother. It's going to require Hillary to become a better candidate. And what I mean by that is when she has these moments, where she can prove authenticity, where she can, it's an emotion. This is an emotional decision at this point. She's saying the right things, Jason. Arthur, she's saying the right things, but we have to feel that we can believe that she will actually bring those things to fruition and that she will expend the political capital to get it done. You can promise me anything, but but at the end of the day, you go dance with another guy. I mean, hey, you know, what good is that? So we just need to believe in her. And can she do that? Can she undo the flip-flopping and the rebounding and the jump shots and the fadeaways that she's been doing and then prove to us that, yes, no, this is the real Hillary. The real Hillary just stood up. Are we going to be able to believe that? So that's the thing.
She's got to make faith.
Man, she's got to do it, man. If she can do that, I think she can secure the election.
Oh, man. All right, man. This is a start, I guess, for you, for everyone left in this race. You're a winnable, gettable voter, and see how it goes, man. Thanks for coming on the show. This is great.
All right, now. Thank you, guys. You take care.
Yeah, we'll talk to you again soon, I hope. All right, that was Tim Black. He is the host of the Tim Black Show, which you can watch on YouTube or download on iTunes. We have a great show. Please stick around. We'll be right back.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
And we're back. Joining us now, we have Zachary Carter.
Hello, everyone.
Carter. And we also have Lauren Weber.
Hey, guys.
Editor of the Morning Email.
Always a party.
Yes, exactly. And speaking of parties, we want to sort of just like tip up the curtain a little bit because next week we got two. Well, we start our quadrennial obsession with political conventions, beginning with the Republican one in Cleveland, Ohio, and then eventually moving to Philadelphia where the Democrats will do theirs. But this week, first of all, Arthur's not here, so we can talk about the time concession we're making. Let's just say the vice presidential pick Trump made that you know about, we're still absorbing it. It's still too much for us to absorb and talk about.
We don't know if it's real yet.
It's still not sure.
All right, we'll just tell you right now, we're recording this before Friday. So
since you're listening to this after Friday morning.
Yes. So this week we finally did get a sense of the kind of people that we'd be coming to speak at the Republican convention in Cleveland.
And what a batch they are.
4 years ago, this was out 3 weeks in advance. This time it's more like 3 days in advance. And it features Tim Tebow and a bunch of politicos that you may or may not have heard
of.
And Peter Thiel, who will be...
I believe it's pronounced Thiel.
Thiel, you're right. Yeah. It's Thiel.
That's my bad.
It's spelled Thiel. He's a very rich man.
I was just being bitter because of the Gawker shutdown.
Sure. Mm. Yeah, that's on strategic lawsuits against public participation night at the convention, which is the third night. There's going to literally be a night about Benghazi.
And Clinton's infidelities.
And literally a night about Clinton's sex life.
Bill Clinton.
What?
Bill Clinton's sex life.
But
Bill
still, Clinton. What? I mean, I don't... What?
Because it's the 90s, man. It's the 90s.
I wish it was the
well, 90s. Well, the... conventional wisdom.
Ooh. Oh, back with the pun.
Would be that
auditioning to be on With All Due Respect.
The conventional wisdom in most of these conventions is that you do want to get your base fired up, right?
Yeah,
about the things that matter to the base. It's a big party for people who identify as being Republicans. But there are a lot of Republicans who, like, maybe don't agree with Trump on a lot of issues because it's not clear that Trump agrees with himself on a lot of issues. But we do know that Republicans don't like Bill Clinton, probably because of the sex, but mostly because he used to be a Democratic president. And we also know that Republicans know something fishy happened with that Benghazi stuff. There's something that's not quite right with that. And that's what they like to talk about. So, I mean, I don't think it's that. I think it's kind of like... It makes them look dumb, but if the goal is to just try to connect with Republican voters who maybe Donald Trump has not connected with so far, I don't think it's a terrible strategy.
I'm surprised they're not just like live streaming that 13 Hours movie again.
You don't know. They might be.
They might be.
Yeah.
I mean,
this is like an unofficial draft leaked about who would be speaking at the convention.
Yeah. So you heard it from here first. That's happening.
I also think, don't you think maybe you could have focused on like the Clinton email scandal instead of Benghazi at this point?
I would have thought that would have been more, obviously it's had a hit on her in the polls. Why would we not focus on that more?
To be perfectly sure, I'm sure it will come up.
Just maybe, Jason, just maybe.
But yeah, I guess they're not going to have a night about that. And that's really interesting because as we've approached the convention, polls have tightened. Both national polls and swing state polls have tightened. It's been probably the worst polling week of Clinton's life. And I say it that way because Trump has not gained much elevation. We've just seen some support.
She's just dropped.
She's just dropped. And finally, we're seeing that the FBI's ruling in the email case is playing a role. Now, Trump kind of boofed that the first time he had a chance to talk about it. And he's kind of boofing it now because in the specter of this convention, he's also suing a former aide named Sam Nunberg.
For $10 million.
Which seems to be a huge kind of distraction. But... at the same time, yes, it seems weird that they're going to go back and refer to Bill Clinton's infidelities instead of something that seems to be actually generating movement in the polls, at least negative movement for her.
Yeah. And it's funny, too, because it's not like Trump has this like record of being this super, you know, upright and non-philandering,
respectful fellow. Spend that time on that? I mean, seriously, though.
It's not like hypocrisy ever damages Trump with Republicans, at least.
Yeah,
so.
He has
the ultimate Teflon.
He has Pam Bondi, the Florida AG, coming to speak at the convention. And this is literally an attorney general he bought off to keep her from investigating Trump University. Like, if you were thinking
Lord.
He would go and, like, do his best to sort of, like, not remind people of his improprieties, guess what? I think a lot of news has been focused on like the Republicans who aren't going to this convention, and there are a lot of jokes being made that like there's not a lot of star wattage at this convention, both in terms of like the sort of like celebrities that he thought he'd bring and the
Tim Tebow, woo,
and that's a step down from Tom Brady,
and the politicos who many of whom will be avoiding this for various reasons.
I think it's just one reason.
Well, you're right. Sorry, I didn't mean to suggest that there's any more but one reason. But I think that we maybe tend to joke about that. But I mean, when I think about it rationally, this has always been the anti-establishment campaign. So the fact that there's not a bunch of front benchers and back benchers from the House and Senate attending, I don't think it bothers Trump one bit, and I don't think it bothers his fans one bit. And in terms of celebrities, it's a political convention. When have they ever had top celebrities at a political convention? It's always a little bit lame because politicians only really know lame people.
And occasionally when you do have somebody who's a top tier celebrity, particularly with Republicans, it often backfires. Like we all remember in 2012 when Clint Eastwood showed up and just weirded everybody out, right? And that was the big celebrity moment that Republicans got out of it. I don't think Clint Eastwood not weirding everybody out would have been like this great PR coup that would have helped Republicans win the 2012 presidential election either. It's a party for people who it's your reward for being somebody who spends enough money to go to the convention.
Yeah, yeah,
for being
exactly.
Somebody who for your life has been really committed to this party's, you know, sort of partisan political process. I do think with respect to the Democratic side of things, which we don't have, you know, we don't have information just yet about how that is going to shape up because it's still a week away. We don't yet have a real clear idea of what the Democrats are running on.
Oh yeah, that's a
very good point.
And you know, we can't talk about what people are going to show up, but
we don't know.
Right, but so far it seems to me, and you mentioned the poll numbers earlier, that the basic strategy for the Clinton campaign is to talk trash about Donald Trump and then try to sort of rely on a cult of personality around Clinton herself. I mean, the main slogan is "I'm with her," rather than talk about specific policy issues that, you know, they want to see happen in the next couple of years. Like, this is what we're going to do. And that just seems like it's not a particularly good strategy. So they do have an opportunity to maybe figure that out and do something about it. But it would be nice, I think. I think I would be less frightened of a fascist takeover if I saw some sort of coherent policy message coming from the Democrats.
I feel like, though, there'll be loads of fabulous speeches, at least at the DNC, no? I mean, don't you think there'll be a couple moments where some stars are born, or no?
Well, I mean, we know, for instance, that Elizabeth Warren is going to be there.
Yeah.
And she gives pretty good speeches. So there'll be at least one.
Bernie Sanders is giving a speech, no?
He gives pretty good speeches to Democrats. So. You know, I also think, if you remember 2012, I mean, people who have been Clinton supporters for a long time. I mean, Bill Clinton, of course, but people sort of lowered on the totem pole, like Jennifer Granholm, former governor of Michigan. Mm-hmm. She gave a total barn burner for Obama in 2012.
It was really good.
They've got a lot of people who can give speeches and make Democrats feel awesome. Remember Joe Biden?
But to go back to what you're talking about, they'll have a lot of people Democrats love, and maybe a lot of people that come off as perhaps more humane to independent voters. But you're right. I still am looking for that sort of like purchase of where this campaign stands on things. I just want to just point out one thing. This week, there's a McKinsey study out that said that 81% of U.S. households have experienced flat or falling incomes over the last decade. That's really the setting for where this is for what's going on and the kind of things that I would expect these parties to address. And I would expect the Democrats to sort of have an answer for this and to talk about this. But I've been relentlessly suffocated by Clinton's focus on the professional class and all of this.
Mm-hmm,
to me, when she talks about, oh, well, we're going to make it easier for people to start tech startups, it's like she read Jim Vandehei's weird innovation party platform.
I'm sure she talked to him about it.
I'm sure she did.
I bet you he called her.
And that's where she's pitching it.
Yeah.
And I can see why, because I feel like it's almost like a media strategy.
Yeah.
The media has never really liked her. She's never been able to get along. Mm-hmm. So she's going to like really go hard at all those kind of like weird professional class obsessions that the media has with innovation and entrepreneurship and try to maybe win them over that way. But I'm still interested in seeing, because I'm in the professional class. I'm a member of the professional class. I'm still interested in seeing Clinton do or say something about politics that's occurring somewhere further than 10 feet radius around my body and life, you know, somewhere else where other people live and where politics happens. And I'm not seeing that yet out of her campaign.
And I think this is kind of, I mean, I do think that policies like raising the minimum wage, you know, equal pay, these are things that act, that do affect working people, not just professional people.
I mean,
right. And if you look at the party platform debate that's gone on, you know, a lot of times these are really, really boring processes. But some years it does seem like the platform is a big deal and it matters to people. And there have been these really, really heated, tough, close debates over the language in the Democratic Party platform, which is not official yet. And then also these really complex behind-the-scenes deals between Sanders activists and Clinton delegates for where they put forward, you know, compromise amendments. So it's really clear that there are people in the party who are really, really obsessed with what the policy agenda is going to look like. But I would just like to see, you know, two or three things. Like you know, I felt like you could criticize the Sanders campaign for being short on details and specifics, right? But you knew what he was going for, right? It was like, he's going to make college free, and he's going to make health care – to give everybody health care, single-payer health care. That was like, okay, all right, he's going to break up the banks, too.
Yeah, I was going to say, sure. Don't forget that.
Right. But you knew that. It was, all right, well, that's basically the Sanders platform, right? The Clinton platform, it's like there are a thousand little things, which basically to me say, if I were going to sum it up, we will be competent technocratic managers of the state. And that doesn't seem like it's – you know, I mean, even the way that people talk about Trump as being Trump being unqualified or temperamentally unfit – I mean, it's sort of just like saying, hey, I have a better resume.
We'll diversify the boardroom in Northrop Grumman.
Yeah. Oh, dear Lord.
Yeah, okay. Well, next week, we get started the Republican convention in Cleveland. The Huffington Post will be there covering it. Please tune in and listen and watch and read. And then we'll be in Philadelphia after that. So thanks, guys.
Miss you already.
Thank you.
We'll be right back. Welcome back. So 1 year ago, on July 13, 2015, 28-year-old African-American woman named Sandra Bland was stopped by police on a routine traffic stop in Waller County, Texas. She ended up dead in her prison cell later on that day. There have been a lot of questions about how she came to perish while in police custody. We at the Huffington Post are going to peel back the onion in a different way and take a look at the way many, 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 many people keep perishing in police custody, both under mysterious circumstances and preventable ones. Joining us to talk about an extensive survey that was taken of the U.S. prison industrial complex, we have Ryan Riley. You can say hello.
Oh, hello. How are you? Yeah. Thanks for having us.
That was your cue to say hi. And Dana Liebelson.
Hello. How's it going?
She knows what
she knew
do.
Exactly.
She's a pro.
She's a pro, yeah.
So, guys, tell us about this massive project that you undertook to try to learn more about how it comes to pass that people die while in prison or in police custody.
So, we decided that we wanted to count every single death that we could in a jail in the United States in the year since Bland died. Just to clarify, we only counted jails, not prisons. And the big difference here is that jails are short-term facilities for the most part, where most people are not convicted. So we're talking about a population that's not only unarmed by definition, or they should be unarmed, but they also haven't been found guilty of anything. So that was kind of the thinking behind the project, and Ryan will tell you more now.
Yeah, I mean, so essentially we wanted to see basically how often this sort of thing happened. And there were some limited statistics out there, but when we took a closer look at what the Justice Department actually puts out, it turns out that they only put out that data 3 years after the fact. And crucially, it doesn't include the actual names of the facilities or, you know, the names of the people who died or that sort of information. All it includes is the state-level average. So you know how many people maybe died in jails in that state from 3 years ago, but you don't know what facilities it is. And that's really crucial because when you want to actually talk about saying, hey, where do we have the most problems? What jail should we give a closer look to? Where are there problems happening and what can be fixed here? And, you know, who's doing things well even? That's a crucial stat to be able to have, and that's one that is not public, and in fact, actually wasn't even shared within the Justice Department to the part of the Civil Rights Division that is charged with investigating, unconstitutional conditions within jails across the country.
How difficult was it to obtain this information?
So this has been a project that we have been working on for at least the last 2 months, utilizing most of the newsroom and lots of promises for pizza that I will never fulfill.
Breaking news.
Yeah.
Dana Liebelson trumps her colleagues.
So we did a bunch of different things. We scoured news reports. We also filed a whole bunch of public records requests. We had, you know, fellows working on it full time. We were calling coroner's office. We were calling sheriff's departments. Everything we kind of could do to get at the information that we wanted, which was much more detailed than what the Justice Department releases. For example, we were looking at people's names, age, what they went to jail for, and most crucially, sort of how long they were in jail before they died, which leads us to, like, the biggest finding of the project that Ryan is going to introduce right now.
About suicides?
And how quickly people die in jail.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, people, you know, die very quickly when they get to jail, is basically, you know, what we found looking at the statistics. I think, you know, we have, you know, suicides are in the first few days, we have over a third of the deaths take place. So it's pretty quick.
I was struck by just how critical that first 72-hour period is in these cases.
It is. Yeah, it's essential. I mean, you know, it shouldn't be that shocking, though, right? Because there's this thing, you know, of shock of confinement. And I think one thing that that people think about, you know, when they think about, oh, people who are in jail, they may be think of people who maybe, you know, first of all, are convicted, or think of people who have done some serious wrongdoing. So I think one thing we have to think about is that a lot of this is what I artfully termed low-level bullshit in our official data analysis of this. It's, you know, someone driving on a suspended license and you go to jail for that. And, you know, a whole bunch of those, you know, trespassing charges and lower, you know, very minor things of that nature. But you're dealing with a population that, you know, may have some pre-existing mental issues, and also importantly is, you know, maybe never dealt with the jail system before, or perhaps has cycled in and out of it so often that it's essentially ripped apart their lives and destroyed it, and can cause some real mental anguish and pain to these people. I think that we have to, like, step back and think about, you know, a lot of the experts that we talked to are sort of saying that this is something that, because it's so commonplace, it's sort of just accepted. And it is sort of, you know, we should step back and say, okay, putting a person inside of a confined building and not letting them, you know, not allowing them to contact their family members, taking away every form of freedom that they have, sometimes just because they can't afford to pay a certain amount of money for some very low-level offense or, you know, municipal ordinance violation, is an extraordinary, you know, thing to do. I mean, especially
for people who are not convicted of anything in a lot of cases.
Correct. Yeah. So, I mean, you have to have, like, a really powerful reason, or you should have a really powerful reason why this person has to be confined, and it should really have something to do with public safety rather than they owe the state money is not a good way to go about doing that.
Sorry, Dana.
I was going to say, and when he's talking about owing the state money, he's talking about posting bail or posting bond,
right?
Which, you know, Sandra Bland, for example, she couldn't come up with the money for a $500 bond. We have cases where someone was staying in jail, you know, for example, because his family couldn't pay a $200 bond. I mean, it's just, we're talking about really low levels of money, and it's keeping people in jail where they might really be having a psychological breakdown, where they don't have the medical or the mental health resources to help them get through it. It's a big problem.
And the incredible thing is, too, I mean, with the Bland case, you know, that was $500, but that would have just been to pay a bail bondsman, right? So her actual fee was $5,000, which was, you know, sort of insurmountable for her, and I think a lot, you know, a majority of Americans.
Well, one of the things that we've written about here is the extent to which, yeah, this is low level bullshit, but it all adds up to real profitability for municipalities. Some of these municipalities rely on their local criminal justice jail concerns to be revenue generators. Was there any kind of, like, correlation to that? Is there a takeaway? Did we learn anything about the role of these kind of, like, crazy, hyped up revenue generating operations like we've seen in St. Louis County?
Yeah. So, I mean, so one thing is that a lot of the bails are often very closely tied to the underlying offenses or the fees that the person owes. So those sort of are mashed up together a lot of the time. time. So, you know, you'll get arrested and it turns out that you had a warrant because you didn't appear in court because you thought that the judge was going to throw you in jail because you couldn't pay these fees, because a lot of these courts don't really operate very fairly at all. So when you are, you know, next pulled over for a traffic stop, that you're someone's going to see all of those, you know, outstanding warrants. They're going to take you and they're going to hold you until you pay that money. Yeah. And, you know, that money is, in theory, it's supposed to be, you know, saying that you're going to appear in court again. But in practice, that you're never going to see that money again. That's all going to go towards your underlying fees that you couldn't afford in the first place, just to buy yourself out of a confined cell. And that's, you know, one of the women we talked to in the project is actually a woman who tried to commit suicide and thankfully survived. Inside a facility in Berkeley, which was right next to Ferguson, and, you know, had a lot of the same problems that Ferguson did and have a lot of the same problems that St. Louis County did. And I mean, she was taken in and she's on food stamps, she's on disability, and she has some underlying mental health issues, and, you know, she's a mother of three, and this wasn't a situation, she couldn't afford to buy herself out. She owed over $2,000 in order to, you know, buy her freedom, essentially. And that was something that, you know, was insurmountable for her. And when I went to talk to the police chief there about it, I mean, he was pretty dismissive overall, I think, about just the idea of the conditions that he kept her in, and he kept other people there in, you know, saying basically it wasn't so bad, you know, basically that she only attempted suicide because she wanted to get out. But also just was very dismissive of the idea that this was a woman who couldn't afford what they were asking of her, and, you know, said, well, she could certainly afford the pot that that she had bought. I mean, it was just very, you know, dismissive. Okay. Yeah.
I mean, because I think a lot of people do understand that sometimes they get knit up in the system and they're stuck in debt, and that maybe adds to the hopelessness.
Yeah, it's a really kind of vicious cycle that we see people get caught in.
And the reason I bring up the whole profitability argument here is that as a lot of people have argued recently, especially when you pair this with the overall gun violence you see in the streets, that right now we've kind of asked our police force and our criminal justice system to be now the first interveners and the first responders in America's exploding mental health crisis.
Right.
And do you think that some of the profits that are being made could be plowed back into making the system better? Because it seems to me that you, in your piece, you guys' piece, you cite at least one example of a facility that actually does have healthcare professionals intervene, and it's actually causing a beneficial effect on prison population or jail.
Yeah,
population.
I talked to a county in Texas that utilizes something called a crisis intervention team. And what they do is, you know, they recognize that sometimes people just need mental health treatment and they're committing offenses due to mental health issues. So what they do is they divert people into the mental health system instead of charging them with a crime. Last year, they diverted over 200 people. And they sort of estimated in a ballpark that was saving their county hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, because it's really, really potentially more. It's very expensive to keep people with mental health issues in jail and give them the fair, like, humane treatment that they need. So, you know, I would say absolutely, you know, keeping people out of jail is going to save counties money in those, like, nonviolent cases, right? Like, we're not talking about charged with murder.
So by the time you all will be hearing the segment, this piece will be up on the Huffington Post. Is there anything that you really would urge readers and our listeners to really think about, having been through this process and done this very, very arduous research? What would you say is the main thing you'd like people to focus on when thinking about this?
I mean, to me, I think that, first of all, sort of open up your mind about what sort of the underlying offenses are in these cases. And right, a lot of people go to jail. You know, there's a lot of things. Pretty much, I would venture to say that the vast overwhelming majority of people in the United States, probably something in the 90-something odd percentile, have done something within their lives they could have been arrested for. I mean, in Texas, actually, it turns out there's the underlying offense of having a broken taillight actually can be an arrestable offense. So, I mean, pretty much everyone has done something that they could have gone to jail for. And I think that there has to be a conversation about, you know, how we're using jails and whether or not and what purposes and what we're really using these facilities for, and whether, you know, the practices that we have are just so commonplace, and, you know, sort of reevaluating and rethinking about the way they're used would save a lot of lives, as well as just implementing these practices that would just save lives of people who do have to be held for some reason.
All right.
Can I add one more thing?
Yeah, definitely.
I would just urge people to reach out to us. A lot of people have family members and friends who've been to jail. It feels like a really isolating experience, especially if you do know someone who's died in jail, but it doesn't have to be that way. And it's not something that, you know, a family has to burden alone, because a lot of times there's a lot of systemic stuff happening behind it. So, you know, we're trying to still fill out our database. So we're urging people to reach out to us with more information. Yeah, check it out.
All right. Ryan, Dana, thanks so much for coming on the show. You guys should head out to the Huffington Post and look for that. It will be under our Highline section, and it should be there waiting for you to explore. It was a lot of hard work. These guys deserve a lot of commendations, and if anyone can help, maybe Dana help subsidize all that pizza promise. We'd be interested in that, too. All right. Thanks, guys. We will be right back. We're back. Do not adjust your audio settings if we sound a little different, because we have left the studio for the segment, and we have been graciously welcomed into the office of Wisconsin Congressman Reed Ribble. I'm with Arthur Delaney.
Hello.
Thank you for having us in your office.
Well, thanks for coming over. It's good to see you guys face to face.
It is great. It is really great. We have a bunch of things we want to talk about today. I guess the first thing we want to talk about is a little bit of like legislative action, Arthur.
Well, Congressman, this week you dropped some serious legislation, and it's about Social Security. It's bipartisan, and it seems like it's your last hurrah, because we're about to have this huge August recess, and then you won't be sticking around for another term. So tell us about the timing and the legislation itself.
Well, the timing was in part that in the last 5 or 6 years that I've been working on this issue, I kept expecting somebody to do it. Every budget hearing I was in, the actuaries would come in and say, you guys need to fix this. The program's going insolvent in 2032 or 2034. Time is your friend. It's also your enemy if you wait too long. But I was expecting the committees to do it, but they didn't. And so about a year and a half ago, I started really working on the arithmetic. It's fairly complicated. And began to try to craft what I felt was the broadest, most balanced solution to fixing the Social Security system that the country's seen since 1983.
And you kind of previewed it a little bit on a previous podcast. And this, your approach has been to either sort of like approach it from a standpoint of, we'll do something everyone likes/hates, and we'll see if we can, we'll see if people will pass it on the basis of its comprehensiveness.
Yeah, I think if you look at any of the provisions in a vacuum, just that provision, there's a lot of things that would cause you to reject it.
Yeah, it gets freighted with
right.
politics.
But if you look at the whole thing, you're better able to say, you know what, I can take this provision because they did that provision as well. So it's a blend of about one-third of increased revenue, a blend of about one-third correction by adjusting the age, and one-third by manipulating the benefits so that we can redirect more money to those in poverty and very aged while protecting the middle class. Simultaneously, if you've done well in this nation's economy and you're earning above the cap, which is $118,000 today, we're going to readjust the cap back to where it was in 1983 when Ronald Reagan did his reform, and it will collect on 90% of payrolls rather than the 81% of payrolls we're doing
now,
it today.
Congressman Reed Ribble, that's a little wonky, but this is the most interesting part, perhaps, from a politics perspective, because you're a Republican, and what you're describing is a just giant tax hike. So describe more about the cap and what you would do to change it.
Yeah,
under this
yeah.
legislation.
And I might challenge that it's a giant tax increase, but
sure,
it's a tax increase.
Let
me put it to you this way. We have a massive hole of $11.4 trillion. This increase in revenue is about one-third of that over 75 years. However, the cap is set at $118,000 in rough numbers today, meaning if you earn $80,000 a year, you're going to have Social Security withholding on 100% of that. Mm-hmm. If you own $236,000 a year, you're going to have Social Security withholding on one half of it. And so what I'm saying is, let's take a look at all payrolls that are received inside the United States, and let's set that cap at a level that we're capturing the tax on 90% of those payrolls. So it still stays a bit regressive because the payout is progressive, but we get that cap back up so that today's worker is paying an equivalent in today's dollars to what their parents paid in 1983, because right now the tax is actually lower in real dollars than it was then.
So the likelihood of Congress taking this up, I mean, it's not coming out of the Committee of Jurisdiction. It's going to be a lame duck Congress. It seems not all that likely, but are you hoping that by virtue of yourself being a Republican and your Republican co-sponsors, that this is something of an icebreaker?
Well, I've got bipartisan co-sponsors, so that helps. It's the only bipartisan bill on Social Security reform that's in the Congress right now. And quite frankly, guys, with the power of this show and the reach of this show, this could just shove it over the top.
We know, yeah.
You're not exaggerating.
In reality, I appreciate that. In reality, though, you have almost the perfect storm here. You've got a Republican Congress with a Democrat president. You have the Democrat president outgoing with a legacy on his mind. This is the type of bipartisan fix that could happen in the lame duck, because it would solve a problem and take it off the table for the future Congress and president.
He used to talk about wanting a grand bargain, but that's been out of style for at least
he never really talked about wanting a grand bargain, because he set up the Simpson-Bowles Commission, then rejected the grand bargain. However, he did offer in 2013 with his budget proposal to go to a different form of COLA, the cost of living adjustment, which would bring the benefit down just slightly for seniors. But most people in Congress rejected it because it was offered in a vacuum without any other benefit changes. So in essence, what the president was saying is, we're going to put the entire onus on the backs of seniors.
Yeah.
And so his own party rejected that. If he had said, you know what, guys, I'll do the COLA if you'll do something on the cap, he would have started the framework of getting to this deal. Whether this happens this year or 10 years from now, this will be the framework that it's going to be.
You've created a precedent.
That's right.
For it. So you're leaving Congress, and we've asked you a bunch of questions in the past about your experience here and how things could be better. We've talked about biennial budgeting. We've talked about – what was the thing we talked about before –
We're talking about putting cameras.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Getting rid of the cameras.
Yes, you defended a lot. Some people say get rid of the cameras. You defended the cameras here. We've walked in the office. We know you have C-SPAN on. So we know you're a big C-SPAN fan. So my question today, and this is a really controversial thing, government reform. Some argue that what I'm about to suggest would bring back was corrupt. And other people argue that it was actually necessary to grease the wheels. What about bringing back earmarks?
No, well, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned that. I'm not a big fan of the overall earmark ban, again, done in a vacuum, where we just say, carte blanche, you can't do this. Because under the U.S. Constitution, the power of the purse resides here in the Congress, not in the executive branch. By eliminating earmarks where members of Congress can actually target that spending, you're basically saying, here you go, President. Here's some money. Do with it
right.
what you
it's
want.
It's your job to spend the money.
And what I would have preferred that the Congress had done, rather than just saying we're not going to do earmarks anymore, that they would say we're going to have on every authorization or every appropriation, we're going to have a period of debate on earmarks that members can go to the floor of the House. It's all publicized. It's all on TV. It's all covered. And make your case in front of the American people of why you need the money for this dredging of this port in your district or this new road that has to be built, and make the case in a transparent fashion so that if, in fact, it is just wasteful spending, you then will have to bear the brunt of that with your voters back home.
People say that without earmarks, there is now no way for legislators on the losing side of a big legislative fight to save face. And that sort of like ramps up the need to notch the ideological bedpost back home. Because when you've lost big debates on Obamacare, when you've lost big debates on Social Security, you've got to go back and tell your constituents, well, we fought for this, what you wanted, and we didn't bring it home. But you used to be able to say, but there's an airport now. There's an off-ramp.
The Reed Ribble airport off-ramp.
Now you can't say that anymore.
Well, that's true. You can't really say that anymore. Since I've only been here under the post-earmark ban, the earmark ban happened the first week I was here.
Right, yeah. You never got to enjoy it.
I never got a chance to experience what the dynamic was, what you're describing as a quid pro quo was
behind such, a, such a dirty word.
Behind the scenes. And so I wasn't able to comment on it. But I do think that the system would work better, and Congress, those of us who represent individual citizens in our own congressional districts, we know what those federal needs are in our districts better than what a federal agency would.
So, Congressman Reed Ribble, are you going to Cleveland next week? Huffington Post will be there, and like 15,000 other journalists.
It'd be cool to see you.
You guys are going, so it's absolutely not necessary for me to be there. I can just tune in and watch it on
Michael
TV.
Simon's got a good barbecue joint.
But no, I'm disappointed. I thought maybe I was going to be getting a speaking engagement, but it didn't come. The invitation didn't
show
up.
You weren't on the draft.
I wasn't on anything.
A handful of Republicans will be there.
Yes, well, no, there's going to be a lot of Republicans there. There'll be a lot of grassroots Republicans will be there. I believe that attendance at this convention will be very high, in part because it is a unique moment of history. There is no other candidate that's been like Donald Trump. And so he's going to draw both the good and the bad to Cleveland. And I would expect there to be a fair number of protests outside, vocal protests, and I would expect it to be a raucous meeting inside.
I think it's going to be like kind of the Gapers Block convention.
Well, I have no idea what they're going to be doing, but I like you. Well, you're going to be watching it from your remote screen outside the convention hall. I'll be watching it from my television.
Even more remote.
Yes, even more remote.
Do you feel that Donald Trump is getting a higher level of respect right now by virtue of his being the Republican nominee? For instance, Ruth Bader Ginsburg apologized for merely calling him a faker.
I think what she did wisely in even that move from her standpoint was a political move, because she took the weapon away from him, because he's been able to rail about that for 2 weeks now. And by her coming out and apologizing, something that Donald Trump apparently has never done in his life, she actually took the chain and let it go.
But I mean, who was apologizing to him before he was nominee?
Well, yeah,
it seems like there
is a certain amount of gravitas that you have being the presumptive nominee, and ultimately, I believe, will be the nominee. And so he's clearly got a lot of support out there, and his enthusiasm in Wisconsin isn't as big as other parts of the country, so it's a little bit tougher for me to measure.
Really, Wisconsin seems very immune to his charms.
He's not real popular there. I think he's gaining popularity, and I think some of the polls are showing that. But conservative talk radio is still not on the Trump bandwagon.
Not in Wisconsin.
That's correct.
You call him a 3-year-old. Does this gravitas make him more of a 5-year-old?
No, not in my opinion. I think you're kind of right where he is. I think I sized him up right the first time. The first time I said that, by the way, someone called my office within minutes and said I had to apologize to every 3-year-old out there because it was an insult to them. But it wasn't intended to do that. I used that language in part to focus attention on the fact that at some point we have to elevate our dialogue. The idea of throwing sand at each other in a sandbox is not how you resolve conflict in this country. You resolve conflict when you are able to sit down with someone side by side and show enough common decency and respect that you can hear them out.
So exactly what's not really happening right now.
That's what? Right.
Despite the increased gravity.
I mean, right now in America, not right now on this podcast, because I think we're being pretty great right
There's
now.
There's no one's throwing sand in here.
Right. I think we're setting an example.
Let the record show.
We are.
All right. Well, this is great. Thank you for having us over to your office. We look forward to having a few more conversations with you before you retire.
Right off into the sunset.
And on really hot, muggy days like this, we wish you getting back to Wisconsin as safe and sound and as quickly as possible, because it is gross out
there. The weather's much better there.
Yeah. All right. Thank you very much, Congressman Reed Ribble, Arthur Delaney. We will be right back. So that's what happened this week. This podcast was produced, edited, and engineered by Christine Canetta. Our executive producer is Nick Offenberg. I'm Jason Linkins. This week, we were joined by Wisconsin Representative Reed Ribble, host of The Tim Black Show, Tim Black, as well as Huffington Post reporters Zach Carter, Arthur Delaney, Dana Liebelson, Ryan Riley, and Lauren Weber. So That Happened is available on iTunes at itunes.com/So That Happened. Check out the whole family of Huffington Post podcasts in the iTunes store.
And while you're there, subscribe and tell your friends. If there's something you'd like to hear us talk about, send an email to sothathappened@huffingtonpost.com. Thanks to all of you for listening. We miss you already.